I think the people of this country think I'm right. Again, I could have done nothing. I could have had a lot easier presidency by doing nothing. But I'm here. I want to do it right.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check. And that was President Donald Trump on Wednesday, saying that he has no plans to end the government shutdown until he gets funding for a border wall. On today's episode, I'll be joined by my colleagues to talk about that shutdown and what's ahead for Congress and the states in 2019. But before we get to that, here's my plug for you to help us by rating our show. Just go to your favorite podcast app. You can write a review. We haven't had a review on iTunes in a whole year since 2018. We have some interesting guests scheduled for coming weeks, and we're also planning to do a book club episode on And the Band Played On, the classic investigation of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, if you want to get that book and read along with us. A reminder, you can always find me by email at ddiamond@politico.com with suggestions and tips. And now, let's get to this week's show. On today's show, we'll walk through three topics: the state of the shutdown, what is ahead for Congress, specifically for healthcare, and then what's happening in the states with regards to Medicaid expansion mostly. And to talk through that, I've got two of my colleagues. First, Adam Kankren.
Happy New Year, Dan.
Our do-it-all reporter who focuses a lot on the Hill. And Rachna Pradhan.
Happy New Year, Dan. Good to be back.
Back from Arkansas, among other places you've recently visited. And we will talk about that reporting very soon. So let's start with the shutdown. The government's been partially shuttered for 2 weeks. About 800,000 employees' salaries are directly affected. There are countless ripple effects, and there is no clear path toward a resolution. Adam, you're on the Hill, the most of the three of us. What are you hearing from congressional leaders?
Well, I think what we're hearing now is kind of what we've heard over the past couple weeks and throughout the holidays, is that there's no real clear path to a deal here. You have the president on one side who's saying he wants his $5 billion for a border wall and that he's not budging from it, and spent, you know, basically the whole holiday season here cooped up in the White House saying that he's not budging from that line. And you have Democrats who say they have all the leverage, and there's no reason for them to budge from their $1.3 billion in border wall funding that they'd thrown out in the first place.
So you don't think Republicans have some leverage and that Democrats have this agenda that they wanted to accomplish, and because they're tied up with the shutdown, they won't be able to move forward with the envisioned agenda for early 2019?
If there is some leverage, it doesn't seem like Democrats are worried about it, and I think for two reasons. One, they're pretty confident that voters are ultimately going to blame Republicans more than Democrats for the shutdown and all of the various effects that people being furloughed and not being paid, national parks being shuttered, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing is that, you know, there's this feeling that House Democrats are going to take power on Thursday, and they're immediately going to pass, you know, bills that say, you know, we're passing the budgets for the remaining parts of the government that need to be reopened and kind of putting it in the Senate's hands. And reminder, the Senate is still Republican controlled. So automatically, the onus is on Republicans and on the president to kind of come to the negotiating table and decide that they're ready to deal.
And there's more than just blame to go around. There are real impacts. Listeners to Pulse Check might remember in last week's episode, the crossover with Nerdcast, we talked about the impact on the FDA, which has seen a lot of its staff furloughed and its food safety operation really hindered as a result of lack of funding. So let's shift to what is next for Congress when this Democratic House comes in. There was a story on Politico Pro. Democrats redraw health strategy with an overriding focus on Obamacare. Adam, you co-wrote that with Alice Miranda Olstein. They do have a packed wish list, Democrats.
They
want to lower drug prices. They want to fix the ACA. They want to investigate the administration. Some progressives want Medicare for all. What is the top item on that wish list?
So, like it or not, for Democrats and what they're telling Alice and I, it's we have to focus again on Obamacare. That has to be at the top of the priority list. And the main reason is because right before the end of the year, a judge in Texas came out and ruled that the entire Affordable Care Act should be invalidated. This is based on a court challenge by 20 Republican AGs. I think we've gone over it in previous podcasts a little bit. And so once again, you have this mortal threat to the health law. This time it's not legislative, but it's in the courts. And Democrats, for a couple reasons, are going to kind of make this the top messaging and top priority for at least the first few months in Congress. And one is because, you know, they won, you know, they took back power during the midterm elections based on this whole message that Republicans are trying to take away protections for pre-existing conditions. This kind of renews that message and gives them another chance to really hammer Republicans on that. And secondly, there is a real potential at some point in the future threat to the existence of Obamacare, and not just the markets, but everything that the Affordable Care Act has kind of put in place over the past 8 years.
The payment reforms, the drug changes, and so on and so on.
Exactly.
You had an interesting quote in your story from Pramila Jayapal, the House Medicare for All leader, who basically said, look, we want to do Medicare for All. Here's the quote. I'll read part of it. Quote, we have to do everything we can to shore up the Affordable Care Act while we build the movement for Medicare for All and get everyone on board. So even the Medicare for All folks are saying we will take a back seat to focusing on the ACA in the moment.
Yeah, and there is a debate, there is a fight coming within the Democratic Party about where you go next after the Affordable Care Act. But right now, Democrats for the most part are united on making sure the Affordable Care Act exists first before you try to build on it. There's a sense that, look, there has to be that kind of base in order to then talk about Medicare expansion, you know, doing something that gets toward universal health coverage.
So in addition to Congress coming back, we are out with a brand new poll done with Harvard on top priorities for Congress as per the American people when you survey them. Rach, you've looked at this poll. What are some of those top priorities as they relate to healthcare?
Right. So I think, you know, of course, Congress, and now we can see, as Adam said, they're going to potentially get roped into these debates about the ACA and maybe more existential debates about Medicare for All or how you expand access to health insurance. But for most Americans, I mean, and I don't think this is particularly surprising, but high drug prices are the most important thing that they want Congress to address. We've seen in other prior polls that this has, you know, consistently been a top-rated issue in individuals' mind just because of what they're paying. You know, voters are clearly really frustrated over high drug prices. They want to see Congress do more on the opioid epidemic. I mean, these are things that have broad buy-in, but I think it will be interesting to see, like, how much of these debates, because of the Texas lawsuit, you know, and how that shapes congressional discourse over the ACA, how much does that take away from legislation or legislative activity on things like high drug prices, things like surprise medical bills, things that, you know, other areas that are really, really broadly viewed as things that Congress can do and have a lot of support in.
To put some numbers around that, 80% of respondents said that Congress should move to lower the cost of prescription drugs. That was a top overall issue out of everything, out of the 20-odd things that survey respondents were asked. 74% of respondents wanted movement on the opioid epidemic. But do we know if Congress can work together on anything? We've got this Democratic House coming in, Senate Republicans. Is even drug prices somewhere that they can find common ground?
Oh, that is a – can Congress get anything done in a bipartisan way anymore? I think they can. But again, it does depend on how much – I think a lot of the debates as of late, you know, have been also shaped by the president and what he is willing to put out there and say, okay, I'm willing to support this or not support this. And that can really scramble negotiations between Republicans and Democrats on pretty much anything on the Hill. You know, we also have to mention, I think, when it comes to drug pricing, the pharmaceutical industry is one of the most formidable lobbying forces on the Hill. And so they could potentially sort of stymie any sort of efforts, even when there is bipartisan buy-in to do something.
In terms of Congress being able to accomplish anything, there is new funding for Alzheimer's research and public health investment, about $100 million over 5 years. And this funding took effect January 1st. I must have gotten, I don't know about you two, I must have gotten 8 different messages from different folks.
At least.
Yes.
Because it was a bipartisan effort. Tim Kaine, Cortez Masto, Susan Collins, Capito, like on the Republican side, they were all excited that they had come together to fund Alzheimer's, which, yes, it shows that things work. But it's also like, geez, if this is the moment, like this is the thing that you agree on, fighting this disease that everyone hates. I mean, there is kind of a rule of thumb that Congress will agree on public health priorities, but just not how to fund it. And then it's coverage expansion where things do break down.
Yeah. And a lot of times it comes down to the details, right? So, you know, the majority of people, and I think I don't think it's a stretch to say the majority of Congress believes that something should be done about high drug prices. The question is what, you know, and whether you can get something passed through this divided Congress kind of at this point depends on how much faith you have in Congress, right? So in a story that Alice and I did, one of the things we reported was that Democrats have had some back channel talks with the administration about what the president and what the administration could accept in some kind of a drug pricing package. So if you're an optimist, hey, those are good. That's a good sign. On the other hand, you know, you talk to some Republicans in Congress, and even the, Trump has kind of alluded to this. Once the investigation starts, once the oversight starts, how much goodwill will there really be? And Chris Collins told me right before the break.
This is Chris Collins, the Republican New York, who was investigated for his stock dealings.
Yes, exactly.
Someone who knows investigations well, having lived through them.
And he's a big ally of the drug industry as well. And so I asked Chris Collins, I said, you know, how much realistically are Republicans willing to get done? And he said, well, look, you don't sit down with Kim Jong-un while you're launching nukes at each other. And what he was essentially saying is we're willing to work together. We're willing to negotiate. But not if there are investigations and subpoenas flying around and what the president has tried to brand as presidential harassment, which is really just Congress doing its job as the accountability brand.
Is Collins saying that in part because of his own concern that maybe
I did not go that far. He seemed in a good mood right before Christmas, so I figured I wouldn't push it.
Yeah, well, he won re-election, which was not expected by some. Is there something to the early reports that Democrats are feuding among themselves? Adam, there's news that the Democrats didn't all agree on a rules package. Is there something there, or is this just a media creation of looking for conflict where there might not be?
Well, I think there's a knee-jerk Democrats in disarray style, you know, of story, just the same way as, you know, every time while Republicans were in power, the House Freedom Caucus would do something, it was suddenly, you know, Republicans can't get in line. I think, and Rachna, let me know what you think, but I think that this is more an empowered progressive left that feels like they finally have some influence in a House majority that's in Democratic hands for the first time in nearly a decade, and that this is the time for them to really stand up and say something. Now, we'll have to see how that reflects in the ability for Democrats to get progress on an agenda. You know, this could be a lot of talk and then ultimately gets hashed out and progress is made legislatively. But that's something we're going to have to keep an eye on as we go through here.
Yeah, I think two things I would keep in mind also about Democrats and disagreement. I mean, I do think in prior Congresses, and now this is a dwindling group now, but Blue Dog Democrats used to kind of be a thorn in the side of some among Democratic leadership, even in the debate over the ACA.
And the Blue Dogs were the more conservative Democrats who fought against a public option, for instance.
Right. So it was the flip side of maybe what's happening now. And they often resisted Congress was debating health care. I mean, they would advocate for changes that they felt like would go over better in their districts. And that wasn't always what the majority of maybe the Democrats thought at the time. The second thing is, you know, because of social media, I think we can often now see these things play out in public because people are firing off tweets at each other about PAYGO, for example, or other things that maybe would have been privately discussed before. And so now it just seems much more, I think, vitriolic because of that.
And for listeners who don't know, PAYGO is one of those rules issues where Democrats were debating what needs to be paid for and whether this can kick some of those budget fights down the road as opposed to having to deal with them in this Congress.
Yeah. And this is something that ultimately will come down to Nancy Pelosi as Speaker and how she manages it. So look, you know, greater transparency is great. We're seeing these fights play out in real time. Ultimately, Pelosi has to balance. She's got a whole bunch of centrists who were responsible for flipping the House into Democratic hands in the first place, who are going to be up for re-election again in 2020. You also have this progressive wing that is very intent on pushing the party further to the left. So it's a matter of how she balances and manages those relations there.
Last question before we move on to our segment on the states. Who is the lawmaker that you are watching in 2019? Who's the Congress member? Do I have to answer my own question to start?
No, I can say I'll take this one because I thought of one earlier. I think the new chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Chuck Grassley, is definitely one to watch, not just because of the Finance Committee's broad authority over so many things in our federal budget and entitlement programs, but because he has been known to compromise with Democrats, especially on issues that are controversial, like drug pricing. So I think he's expected to perhaps not be as staunch of a defender of the pharmaceutical industry as the Finance Committee's prior chairman, Senator Orrin Hatch. So that'll be something that'll be interesting to watch for sure.
And I'll say Frank Pallone, he's the new Energy and Commerce Chair. He's a Democrat from New Jersey, a longtime Democrat. And you know, when you talk about balance, this is where he comes in as well, because he's going to be in the center essentially of every major healthcare debate that Democrats have over the next couple years. And he's, again, going to have to balance, you know, how much do you compromise with the administration on drug pricing versus how much do you push for Medicare negotiation and reimportation of drugs and some of these kind of, you know, liberal goals. And he's going to get plenty of criticism from both the center and the left of the Democratic Party. It's going to be interesting to see how he handles it.
Yeah, I think my answer would be Elijah Cummings, the incoming chair of the Oversight Committee in the House, for some of those reasons. On the flip side of what you just said about Pallone, if Democrats are going to have to figure out what is the right balance between investigating the administration and working with them, Cummings will be at the center of all those investigations, and he has been waiting for this moment. Every media organization around Washington, D.C. is focused in on the Oversight Committee, because just like during the Obama years when some of the news events were driven by Republican investigations of Benghazi, of the Fast and Furious case, now this will be the flip side of that, and Cummings will be driving a lot of that around healthcare, migrants, and how HHS and DHS handled the border, how the Affordable Care Act was implemented. And, you know, the list goes on. How much of that he will do and how much will be reined in will be interesting to see. Let's move to our last segment, beyond D.C. Even as Congress is split, the Trump administration is pushing ahead on using its regulatory powers, changing state insurance markets, and CMS has already approved a number of state requests, a flurry of approvals right before the end of the year. What is still looming in 2019, Rachna? You are our state reporter. What are you expecting will come down?
Well, I do think just given perhaps if you expect there to be gridlock in Congress, again, you know, especially now because we have a split control of the House and Senate, you know, the Trump administration definitely has a lot of administrative priorities. Drug pricing is one of them. What I cover a lot, of course, is related to Medicaid and the ACA. I don't think there will be any shortage of new, and we already have still pending requests from Republican-controlled states to pare back their Medicaid enrollment in some shape or another, whether you want to institute work requirements or add premiums, co-pays, eliminate certain benefits, especially for the expansion population. I think we'll continue to see that. And by all accounts, especially as you referenced, you know, just before the holiday, CMS got a bunch of waiver requests out the door for Republican governors who are just basically about to leave office. So I think they'll keep pushing ahead.
You're talking about Maine. Paul LePage, the outgoing governor there, got his work requirements approved. And Rick Snyder in Michigan. That was the sixth and seventh work requirement packages?
Yes. And we still have some that are pending. Again, not for they're not outgoing governors, but there is a request pending still for Arizona, which expanded Medicaid. And Governor Doug Ducey was just reelected. And we have some from non-expansion states. I think that'll be definitely an area to watch because the theory behind work requirements before was that these are restrictions that need to be put in place if you are expanding your program to a population that traditionally was never covered by the Medicaid program. But states like Mississippi and Alabama and others, Kansas, that are requesting them have not expanded eligibility. And so where does the administration draw the line on that?
I want to underline that point because this comes up a lot in conversations that I think the three of us have with Republicans, but the average listener might just hear work requirements and not get the nuance that the three of us are getting from people we talk to, which is the folks who are getting covered by the ACA expansion make more money and are not the traditional low-income enrollees. They're still poor,
right?
But they're not as poor.
And they generally don't have children, which is one thing, another difference.
And Republicans have then argued, well, look, this population is different, ergo they should be out looking for work, and applying work requirements is not as bad in that case than it might be applying it to the poorest of the poor.
Right, such as more traditional populations on Medicaid include pregnant women, children, people who qualify based on disability. I mean, those are people the administration has said, you know, we do not intend, or they've sort of suggested based on their historical pattern that they wouldn't necessarily impose work requirements on those populations because they are seen as fundamentally different.
There is a note in Wednesday's issue of Pulse from Joan Alker, the head of Georgetown Center for Children and Family Research, on the attempt to put work requirements in the Alabama Medicaid program, for instance, which is one of those states that has not expanded but is looking to lock down on eligibility.
Right.
You are just back, Rachna, from Arkansas. We've alluded to that a few times. There's a great story that listeners can find in the show notes. Conservative healthcare experiment leads to thousands losing coverage. What did you learn from your trip to Arkansas?
So one of the biggest things that I learned was that, and this is something that I think critics of such restrictions said would happen, and this is bearing out to a certain extent in the state, which is that there are people who are subject to reporting every month saying, essentially showing the state that, okay, I worked the minimum number of hours or I didn't. And the amount of work that it takes to do that every month, and even if they thought they complied, they went online, they went onto the state's website for reporting these hours, and they thought they did it, and something happened. Either the website didn't work, they never got a letter saying that they were subject to the work requirements. There are all these ways that it falls through the cracks, I guess, and so people aren't aware that they might be subject to the work requirements, or something goes wrong, and then they lose their coverage anyway, even though technically they were in compliance with the rules. And I asked every enrollee, either current or prior, you know, do you think that this is unfair, being required to work for your health benefits? And most of them said no. They thought it wasn't that it was unfair. They just saw it as something that, okay, well, I have to do this, and so I'm going to do it because the consequences of not doing it are too great for me. And so, you know, that's sort of interesting to me because I don't know that many people would have anticipated that kind of reaction, even if they thought, well, this is really complicated or I was confused by this, et cetera. But they didn't feel that as though that it was inherently a bad idea.
Well, doesn't that get to the American sense of like self-worth and I want to be responsible? Atul Gawande had a New Yorker story on this like a year ago or so, asking people in Ohio, Republicans and Democrats, should you get health care for free, essentially? And they all said, oh, there should be some skin in the game. It's just when the bureaucracy is so Byzantine mm-hmm. as to make it impossible to testify that you are trying to do these things.
Right. And Medicaid enrollees, I mean, and this has been well documented, you know, because of their low income and, you know, a lot of them don't have permanent housing. They're hard to get a hold of. You don't know if they have a cell phone, all these things. It's just very difficult sometimes to let people know, as even if the state says they're trying to educate people to the extent that they can, that doesn't mean everyone's going to find out.
What do Republican officials say when you kind of bring that to them, right? This isn't a case of people saying, well, I feel like I shouldn't have to work for the benefit of them trying to dodge a benefit. What do they say when you kind of bring these legitimate cases to them of people, you know, like you said, falling through the cracks on, you know, these kind of Byzantine requirements?
So when I spoke to both the governor, Governor Asa Hutchinson, who spearheaded this push, and his director of human services, Cindy Gillespie, both of them would say, I guess, in response to that, one is that they have been doing all that they can to educate enrollees, and they have been doing a lot. You know, they've set up phone lines, they've done outbound calls, they've sent letters, they've tried to educate people about this change. And when they think there are issues or, you know, things are falling through the cracks, then they have tried to make accommodations or updates in response to that. But I think it's just inherently the nature of these types of programs. They can make all the outbound calls in the world, and doesn't mean you have the right cell phone number or the right phone numbers or the right addresses for people. I even saw one of the notices that was sent to an enrollee saying that they were subject to the work requirement and that an exemption of theirs that they had was ending. it was really confusing. A lot of the language was really confusing. It was conflicting. And I thought, you know, who's writing these? Is anyone really reading them? And how does someone even begin to understand that they might lose their coverage because of this rule? So it's not easy. And I think that one of the things that I thought was really telling about what Governor Hutchinson said in particular was that, and to a certain extent, I think this is true. They could do everything perfectly in the world and people would still hate it. The critics would still say that this shouldn't be happening. And it's because they inherently believe that Medicaid should not have a requirement like this in it.
And there are still a bunch of lawsuits out there over that, right? Over just the ability of requirements.
Yes, right. So Arkansas is one of two states, the other being Kentucky, where there's been litigation filed to stop this from happening.
One last point on the Arkansas story, which again is great and listeners can find in the show notes. The title of your story, Rach, is on this conservative experiment, though as some critics would say, this isn't really an experiment. It's actually happening. There are thousands of people. This is not like a model that doesn't have any real-world impact, which is a line of criticism that I think bears some scrutiny. Let's end the podcast today with just a quick debate. Seema Verma is the official at the Trump administration, the CMS chief, who is stamping these approvals. She has talked about Medicaid changes, adding work requirements as things that she wants as part of her legacy. Is Seema Verma the most influential Trump healthcare appointee? And if not, who is?
Adam's looking at me like he wants me to go first. Oh, this is tough. Well, I think really only the president probably would be able to say who his favorite is. And that is also risky because it probably changes by the hour.
Who is his favorite? It's who's most influential.
Who's most influential?
Do you not think it's Seema Verma, Rach? Is there someone else you might nominate?
That's a tough call. I think it would be – I'd have to think about it more. But I do think she's definitely really pushing ahead and getting a lot of things done that conservatives want to see. But I do think FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb is up there. And so I'll leave it to others. Maybe readers or listeners can decide who is more influential in front.
What a dodge.
I know. Well, I don't want to be wrong. So worst thing for a journalist is to be wrong,
letting the reporting bear it out. I'll give an answer, but only because it's the obvious one. It's Alex Azar, hands down. And
HHS Secretary Alex
Azar. HHS Secretary.
Seema Verma and Scott Gottlieb's boss.
Exactly. Number one, because he runs HHS, so therefore he's got to be the most influential, right? And for a couple other reasons. One, that he's the one who's completely set the agenda. So you look at everything from drug pricing to what CMS is doing. He's the one who has to sign off on it, essentially, right? Secondly, he's the one with the relationship with President Trump. And as we've seen over the last 2 years, the relationship, whether you're up, you're down, whether you know he's confident in you or not, that matters a lot. And the fact that the secretary can go into the Oval 3 times a week, that he can call up Trump whenever he wants and say, this is what I want to do, what do you think, is a lot of power to have for a cabinet official, especially in this administration.
I grant you that the Azar-Trump relationship is strong and bears scrutiny and reporting because it's so important. That said, I think both of your answers are total cop-outs. to name the top health officials the most influential person, it makes some sense on paper. But keep in mind, Adam, Seema Verma and Scott Gottlieb were in seat before Alex Azar stepped in.
That's very true.
And Seema was pursuing some of these things before Azar came on board. And to your argument about Commissioner Gottlieb, Rach, certainly high profile, has been out there quite a bit. But I think what's interesting about him is how much that he has done that has been bipartisan or has been seen as, oh, this is not so different from what the Hillary Clinton administration might have done. Seema Verma and CMS, on the other hand, are pursuing a very traditional and ambitious conservative agenda. And I think if you look at the hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people affected by what CMS has done, you can make a pretty good case that she has been kind of the healthcare MVP for Donald Trump.
Well, here's a simple way to tell which one of us is right. About 8 months from now, we'll check in and we'll see how many letters House Democrats have sent to each of the three of them. And whoever has the most, that's clearly the ones that Democrats think were the most influential in shaping the policy the last
couple
years.
Or just the most hated, potentially.
Or the most controversial, yes.
Well, either way you are on, though I'm going to rely on you to do the actual counting. Adam Cankren, Rachna Pradhan, thanks so much for joining Politico Pulse Check.
Thanks for having us.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Adam Kankren and Rachna Pradhan for sharing their time and reporting lessons, and Micaela Rodriguez for producing the show. You can find Politico Pulse Check on all of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for Politico Pulse Check. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com with emailed tips. And you can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.